What a marvellous occasion. And a wonderful opportunity to congratulate Shuja. 85 and still going strong. Thank you very much indeed for giving me the opportunity to contribute to this, to speak about somebody who in herself is a pillar, not just in Hungarian social policy, European social policy, but international social policy, but much wider than that, a major contributor to social sciences throughout the world, and also a wonderful person. The first quotation comes from Shuja's great book, The Society in the Making, in 1979, and I've been using that in social science, there is no neutral act, as the introduction to my lecture courses for years now. And students have acknowledged this and made reference to it. It seems to me it's absolutely central that values are at the core of what we are doing in social policy. And what anybody who has listened to Shuja for a while has learnt is that social policy isn't something that you do to other people, them out there, we the taxpayers, the givers, them the takers. Social policy is about the society we live in and the way we want to create it. And the way we're taking choices the whole time influences the sort of society, it influences our lives and has a very great influence on many other people's lives. And somehow or other, in so many ways, people have slipped away from this into the technical aspects of this particular means test, or this particular way of saving some money and doing it with fewer workers. And the concern has been going downhill rather than creating the sort of society that Shuja has always been talking about. The European pillar of social rights is a very strong in many respects, and I hope all of you will be responding to their invitation to consult on this over this year. But it has incredible limitations. It's within the framework of Europe 2020, seeking growth that is smart, sustainable, and inclusive. So already the economic dominance is coming out. The pillar will set out a number of essential principles to support well-functioning and fair labour markets and welfare systems within the euro area. President Juncker has said it must be future-proof. Nasty implications about the amount of money, the resources that are available. It's much more a servant of the economy in the American model than a social growth and a societal policy strategy that Shuja herself has been concerned with. And so the great contrast is Shuja's constant iteration, inequality matters. I was very fortunate as a young lecturer at the University of Essex in 1970 when Shuja Ferger came and talked there for a year and taught a course on the sociology of inequality, something none of us had thought about. And I got a very vivid memory of sitting in her office one April afternoon where she said, but it's all about inequality. And it's taken me years to realize quite how central that particular point is and how much she has contributed to our understanding of this. If we recognize inequality as well as poverty, then it means that we've got to make changes as well to bring about a different sort of society, which sadly has been going in the wrong direction. It involves structural changes, not just action by them or on them. And in fact, it reveals the limits of conventional social policies, and Shuja has always been arguing for this broader structural societal social policy. The British economist, social historian, socialist, wrote that the welfare state is only a way of redistributing some income without interfering with the causes of its maldistribution. And of course, Shuja would challenge that and is concerned with tackling the causes of its maldistribution. So societal policy for us all, not just limited policies to ease poverty, or even worse, just to control the poor. Now, Tony Atkinson is somebody who, at the same time as Shuja back in the 1970s, was campaigning on this issue of inequality. His great book written recently, Inequality, What Can Be Done, written at a time when he was having treatment for cancer, a marvelous text that I recommend strongly to you, that is concentrated very much not on doing what he did for so many years, analysing what was happening, but here in his probably final book, sadly, What Can Be Done. And he is very sorry that he can't be here today and sends you his best wishes, Shuja. And really, the two of them provided an intellectual momentum. When people were complaining there wasn't a political momentum for tackling inequality, historians will show there wasn't an intellectual momentum, with a few exceptions like Shuja and Tony. Now, the spirit level has brought out very well why more equal societies almost always do better, and provides a very strong argument for why it's important that we reduce the vast levels of inequality. And it stresses the centrality of structural factors and the importance of universal policies with upstream aims. And by this metaphor, I mean not just pulling people out of the water to save their lives, but stopping them from falling in the water in the first place. And sadly, social policy has stepped away so far from this preventive strategy, and it's only alleviating poverty and pulling some out of poverty rather than stopping people falling into poverty in the first place. Michael Marmot has demonstrated that it's not just an inequality matter between the rich and the poor, but all the way across society. The lower the level of people in society in terms of their economic income and power, the worse their health is likely to be. The poorer their living conditions are likely to be. And in report after report, and recently a marvelous one on Europe, he's demonstrated this. And now, a quotation from Christine Lagarde, who is the head of the International Monetary Fund, this body that has committed itself to making markets work and inequalities grow for years. And now she has said, excessive inequality is corrosive to growth. It is corrosive to society. The economics profession and the policy community have downplayed inequality for too long. Now all of us, including the International Monetary Fund, have a better understanding that a more equal distribution of income allows for more economic stability, more sustained economic growth, and healthier societies with stronger bonds of cohesion and trust. The research reaffirms this finding. So it's taken the IMF 50 years to catch up with Shuja Ferger and Tony Atkinson. And the one thing missing from this, of course, is the apology. For all those years that the International Monetary Fund has been widening inequality by strengthening markets. And this is really so. Redistribution works. So why isn't the world changing? This is a really crucial issue. And I want to suggest some ways that if Europe is going to tackle some of these issues of the gross levels of inequality, what it might do. Preventing poverty in the first place helps to reduce inequality. We cannot and must not wait until people become poor because of the things that poverty does to people. It's already a diminution of our society to have a level of poverty. So we must prevent it and push that up the goal of high policy priority. This means more decent jobs and at fair wages, issues that were taken for granted in the 1960s and earlier. Now today have to be fought for in the low pay poverty cycle. It means challenging economic power, challenging the power of many employers whose working conditions are absolutely appalling and offer no prospects for people. So it means strengthening the preventive powers of the welfare state rather than just alleviating poverty or controlling those people who are seen as problematic in some way or other because they take so much of our taxes. It is possible, said B. Cantillon after a big comparative study, to attain a low risk of poverty without substantial spending. Sorry, if it is possible, it has not yet been demonstrated. And this is a crucial issue. But we face major issues of economic and political power and the constraints of the politics of poverty and the language of inequality. A generation ago, Shuja warned us that neoliberal social policy is reviving many of the poor law traditions, with consequences reminiscent of this era. How very right she was. Increased controls, conditions, and sanctions. I used to teach from the poor laws to Beveridge. I feel now we've gone into reverse. This residualization of social policy, so that social policy is only at the bottom to ease things, reinforces inequalities helped by shaming the poor. We've neglected this. Governments constantly say we want policies that work. Work for what purpose? Shaming the poor, demonizing the poor, talking about what's wrong with them that are costing your taxes so much. That policy works. It gets those governments elected, but it doesn't reduce the poverty and inequality that exists. John V. Wilson has brought out very clearly, and he wants to celebrate your achievement with you, Shuja. The language of inequality limits our options by policy closure and research closure. If you're saying, why aren't they getting jobs? You're not going to be saying, are they getting all the benefits they're entitled to? Are the benefits enough? Are they working properly? So that by the very way of phrasing the problems, it closes off certain options. And sadly, with the exception of people like Shuja, it closes off certain research work as well. And so we have far too little work examining what is happening in these areas. So then we come to the individualization of the social. And this, Shuja, must be your most quoted article in British social policy. And in fact, I could go on with a list of many people besides the UK Social Policy Association and the UK Child Poverty Action Group who would like me to congratulate you on your work. But this weakens the poor and strengthens the better off in economic and political power terms. It makes tackling both inequality and poverty more difficult. And there are two elements in this shift of power. The first one is perhaps more familiar. It dismantles collective social provisions. Things are privatized, so people are left to buy in the market, be responsible consumers. Very nice if your pocket is empty. How can you be a responsible consumer? But it also rejects social explanations of poverty, individualizing the causes of poverty. It's their fault. What's wrong with them? And so it becomes a blaming the victim. Why should we worry? Because they're not doing what they should be doing. So I could go on about many issues in this area. Food banks, the increase of penalties. But let me give you a positive example. But first of all, Ruth Lister congratulates you and celebrates your work. And now you've seen my dream team. People who say as people get older, they become more conservative, more accepting the way things are. These four people, Shuja, Tony, John, and Ruth, are very fine examples of social policy economists, social scientists, who are not satisfied with the way the society goes and are concerned to change it. Unemployment and poverty, as Ruth said, are corrosive of citizenship. Now, let me talk about stick your labels. This may be an awkward expression, but it means don't pin your labels on me. And it's a group set up by the Poverty Alliance in Scotland. They launched it before the last national election in Scotland and got all the leaders of the different political parties saying, we will not stigmatize the poor. We will not allow our political candidates to attack the poor and the vulnerable groups. And this is a crucial issue in terms of the othering that Ruth Lister has talked about, the way in which by abusing certain groups, you distance them, exclude them from society. Now, this is a challenge to that, and it's been relaunched with new fervor for the election that's coming up next week in Scotland. Organizations are being asked to say how they will tackle poverty. Political parties to avoid language which stigmatize people. And then an organization to take meaningful action to tackle stigmatizing attitudes within their own operations. And it's very easy to pick up issues about other organizations, but not to recognize the way in which your own organization is stigmatizing and excluding people. Once again, all the political parties, leaders in Scotland have signed up to this. And I think it's making a difference. It does seem to me there's a difference in the official language between England and Scotland, which I'm quite ashamed of, having grown up in England. But particular power of this, it was launched at the same time as the living wage campaigns, where the wage that an employer commits to pay is above the minimum wage, distinctly above the minimum wage, so people are better off. And the Scottish Government has committed to pay this, and so have many other employers across Scotland. And this is a very important issue. But, and this is a crucial issue, you can't get rid of inequality by tackling it at one end only. We've got to the ridiculous position at the moment of the pay of the executives of the top 100 companies in the UK. It's 183 times the amount of the average worker. 183. Just 4 years before, it was 160. 10 years before that, it was well below 100. But we talk about inequality in the same way we did 10 or 15 years ago. It's absolutely ridiculous. And only a quarter of these 100 firms accept the living wage. Oh no, we can't pay that. There'll be problems. We'll have to lay off workers. Mind you, I expect my bonus. Why should somebody who gets £1 million a year as a banker get £2 million a year as a bonus for doing his job? Something has gone wrong with societal policy. So the language of inequality again. People talk about earnings. But do they earn their £3 million? Or are they just paid it? And sadly in our country, there are many people who earn much more than they're paid in working poverty. But there is certainly now far too many people who are paid much more than they earn. We hear after the credit crunch in 2008, never again. But last year, the head of British Petroleum, BP, got 20% pay increase to £14 million, even though the value of the firm had fallen and the share price had dropped. He gets a 20% pay increase as opposed to 1 or 2% for the national average. The shareholders voted 60% against. Does it make a difference? No, he's already been paid it. He won't be asked to give it back. It was just an advisory, not a binding vote. How ridiculous. A reward for failure. So we need a single standard across society that people like Shuja Ferga, Peter Townsend and others have been arguing for years, and in fact put beautifully by the British historian Richard Tawney in 1913. Improve the character of individuals by all means, if you feel competent to do so, especially of those whose excessive incomes expose them to peculiar temptations. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we follow that policy through? Now, there are efforts. The EU has tried to impose a bonus cap on bankers, proposals to require top salaries to reveal their pay ratios. But much more needs to be done. And at the very least, we need to know who pays. And here we come to my only table. The sad thing is, and the social sciences should share some responsibility for this, people speak entirely in terms of the first column on the left. All that income tax paid by the top fifth, one-fifth of their income goes in income tax. Whereas the bottom fifth pay A fraction of that, one-fifth of that. The newspapers tell us all the time, and so do many politicians, the top 1% pay a quarter of all the income tax. Well, they actually have a vast amount of money from which to pay this. But with their advisory tax lawyers and so, they pay a much smaller proportion than many of us feel they should do. But look at the whole picture and look at the bottom right. You'll see there that the bottom fifth is paying a larger proportion of their own income than the average and the top fifth. Because indirect taxes fall much more heavily on the poor. But we cannot get European figures on this. The political debate is in terms of the language of inequality again, what happens in terms of income tax. We need to open this up and show how property taxes in the UK, indirect taxes in the UK, create a situation where if you want to spend more money on guns or roads or hospitals or benefits, the poor make a bigger contribution of their income than the rich. What an upside-down society. How can we hope to reduce inequality in that situation? Now, I don't know what it would look like in Europe. I don't know what it would look like in Hungary. You have, I think, a flat income tax of 15%. You have higher social security rates than we have, and I think you have higher indirect taxes. So, on that basis, just on that crude information, but not having any hard data, it seemed to me that the problem would be similar, if not worse, in Hungary, and inequality is growing. So one needs to move back to this much broader picture. And to take the advice of people like Tony Atkinson, who advised that instead of comparing countries' GDP, we compare countries' GDP per head. And a whole range of issues that get to the inequalities that exist in our societies. Taking all taxes into account. Norway, you can actually find out how much anybody's income is and how much tax they pay. And in some respects, it's similar in Sweden. Maybe we have to break right the way through to that and insist on that degree of transparency. Only last week, it came out that the British statistics on wealth undercount the amount of wealth by something like 50 or 60% towards the top. And the statisticians are proposing to cut back the amount of information they require from the wealthiest people. So we will have a poorer picture because they can't afford, they've got to cut back on their staff. So we come back to an issue that Shuja has made very clear time and time again. But first of all, let me just give you the illustration that I'm so fond of. The art of taxation consists in so plucking the goose as to obtain the largest amount of feathers with the least amount of hissing. And that great advice was given to Louis XIV, the Sun King of France, by his finance minister, Jean-Baptiste Colbert. In other words, you've got to take account of economic and political power, and so you can't tax the wealthy and the rich as much as you should do. But we live in a democracy where everybody is equal, and we're all in it together, these various remarks that are made. So we need a much fairer tax system. Shuja has said, social policy has always been shaped by social struggles. So it's not simply a matter of putting the information out, although that is crucial. It's astonishing how seldom the information does get out, and it needs to get to other people. But then we have to do something with the information and to campaign and get the information into other groups. And this is where Shuja herself has been such an outstanding example. All these struggles, she said, may be seen as aiming to broaden the scope of social policy into societal policy, improving the quality of society. And that's what we should be aiming for if we're looking at where Europe is going. So we need a societal policy package to bring about fundamental change. Inspired by the work of Shuja Ferger, we need a central European pillar, a societal social growth strategy, not an economic strategy, for which political, economic, industrial and other policies work to create a Europe in which we would like to see our children and our grandchildren and all other children grow up. This must be very embarrassing for you, Shuja, because you really have made an enormous contribution. You made us all think in ways that we were lazily ignoring before. So for all your inspiration, advice and support, thank you very much.